Our presentation this morning is titled Finding Peace and Meaning in Difficult Situations, and it's presented by our member, Dr. Douglas M.L. And he is a little pricey here. I always wanted to find peace in the face of what is felt to be a horrible injustice. This presentation will explore my search to overcome helplessness and find peace through the very difficult situation of being jailed for an offense for which I felt unjustly accused, as well as unfairly tried. Doug is a naturopathic physician who has been practicing for over 15 years in Moose Jaw, where he lives with his wife and three daughters. He has a passion for the protection of the rights and freedoms of the individual, while striving to promote the importance of compassion and kindness, and moving through life with conscious intent. He suffuses his practice with these foundational beliefs. Doug.
Perfect. Hello. Thank you, Alan. So I'll start with, it's really interesting. I was, when I was young, between the ages of about 6 and I'm guessing 12, if memory serves me, I had these recurring nightmares where, 4 or 5 times, I think, where I was jailed or being held captive for something that I didn't do. So I found that was really interesting foreshadowing. And I was always very sensitive. So I had a younger sister sometimes that would like to do things and then point the finger at me and I'd get in trouble for it. And it just, so there was this real tender spot I had for being unjustly accused of something. So it's really interesting how life has a way of foreshadowing, just the bigger picture of life sometimes trying to give us messages at different times. I'm going to start with just a very, very quick history of how I got to the place where I was. Upon graduating in 1998 from the naturopathic medical program, I started to see some real issues in the healthcare system, stuff that was going on that I thought was unjust, unfair, how monies were allocated, how the healthcare system was delivered. And it started me questioning the establishment an awful lot. Up to that point, I hadn't done a lot of establishment questioning. And I came by a book, one called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and it talked about the history of the central banking establishment and how for years they attempted to gain control of the printing of currency. So in other words, they could lend the money out to a country, to a government, at an interest rate in return. And it was about this book talked about these meetings in Jekyll Island, Georgia, in around 1910 to 1914, where this cabal of bankers got together, and there's a lot of documentation for this, and talked about ways that they could start getting this control in Canada and the United States like they had in Europe. And so they succeeded by 1914 in creating the Federal Reserve Act in the United States and the Bank of Canada Act in Canada the same year. And they got it passed in the United States over a holiday season when there were very few people voting in Congress. So the thought was, okay, we have this, and then we start an Income Tax Act. We can blame it on World War I that we need the money. But what it really was an extortion, a way to kind of gain money to basically line the bankers' pockets. And so in reading this, I was extremely angered, extremely frustrated. And I thought, well, that seems unfair. There's got to be a way. How can they do that if we've got a right to our property? How can someone take my shoes off my feet and say, give me those. I want those. I felt that they had no right to. Now, I want to preface this. I'm saying I don't want people to believe necessarily what I believe, but I want you to understand kind of where I was thinking. And so, long story short, because that's not what this is about, I wrote a couple letters to the finance minister, I think it was Jean Chrétien at the time as the prime minister, trying to get some clarity, saying, hey, listen, there's something that seems strange here with this Income Tax Act. I didn't get any answers. I didn't even get acknowledgement. I had a friend who eventually got some acknowledgement 2 years later, which was just, we received your letter. But, so what I did was I restructured my clinic practice in a way that I felt I'd studied about a couple years of how to interpret statutes. So I wanted to figure out, okay, rather than go with what someone tells me, because I learned in medicine, don't just go with what someone tells you. You need to discover for yourself. You need to go to the sources of information as to what is so. So I wanted to learn how to interpret legislation, because it's written in a lot of legalese. And I said, I thought I found exactly, and not just me, others too, the secret to how it seemed like they could infringe on our property rights and somehow make income tax legal. Because I'd had other people tell me, well, it's illegal. It's illegal. They can't get away with it. Not technically, actually. I think they found a way, a sneaky way to actually make it legal. So I thought in doing so, well, I'm going to try and conduct my affairs to step outside of that. So what I did was I restructured my clinic practice this way. And about in 2004, a few months after doing that, we started getting contact from Canada Revenue Agency saying, you know, you're not deducting CPP and EI, and there's some stuff you're not doing here. And there was this interaction back and forth, and I said, well, you know, I'll be happy to comply, but you need to show me how I am falling under the jurisdiction in the way that we've set things up. So there was an interplay, an asking of questions. And I never got any responses. They just say, you need to do this. And I kept asking more questions. And I kept getting the same form letter response where the questions weren't answered. So finally I wrote a scathing 5.5-page letter saying, listen, I'm going to start pressing civil charges if you don't stop harassing me. Well, and that may have not been the smartest thing to do, because at that point they went into silence for 3 years. Then we were searched and seized. It was a September morning in 2007 when, just getting the girls ready for school, 12 agents swarm in on our house, our clinic, my father's house, and start searching, rummaging through. And the interesting thing is, first they bring an RCMP person to go through the house to start looking for weapons and things like that. And we're just shocked to begin with. And this was actually one of the arguments that I brought forth in the legal aspect in the trial. Was, you see, the criminal code allows for a search and seizure based on just an agent saying they're suspicious something's gone on to break the criminal code. But in the Income Tax Act, they're very specific. They say, you know, you have to bring evidence to a higher court judge so he can decide whether or not you get that right to search and seize, because it's quite an infringement on your rights to do so. And the Income Tax Act's a complicated act. So you don't want to just infringe on people's rights unless you've got a really, really good reason to do so. And so what they'd been doing, this government agency, for years was just getting easy rubber stamp searches and seizures through through a justice of the peace, just based on an oath given by an officer saying, hey, I think this person's been evading taxes. So that was a real problem we had. So anyways, I'll fast forward where a year later, charges were pressed, and I'm still thinking, well, you know, I tried to communicate. I wasn't trying to evade anything. I wanted questions answered. And I always felt that, you know, in doing what I did, yeah, there would be a time when things would get questioned, and you'd have to have an interaction with Revenue Canada, maybe in front of tax court or something like that. So I'd assumed that would happen. The worst that would happen is, listen, someone would finally prove to me, listen, this is how you were wrong, this is why you're wrong, and this is how you need to pay the fines that are need to... Okay, fine, thank you for answering my question. That was never done. They found a sneaky way, I think, to just go ahead, press tax evasion charges, take us through a criminal court process. And I had trouble finding lawyers who could argue the point well enough. So we had a couple that we ended up just having to get rid of because they get very, very expensive. And so we went through this trial process, and it was very frustrating because evidence was being denied us that we felt would be very, very important in our defense. Witnesses were able to sit in and listen to others' testimony when I would be cross-examining them later, and I thought that was really suspicious. So I placed a lot of objections during the trial, knowing that it wasn't going well. This wasn't going to look very good. But I always assumed, too, that, okay, sure, we'll get a conviction, and then I'll have a chance to appeal. But what I was shocked at was I was remanded until sentencing. So in other words, I had a chance to, I guess, what you're supposed to do is, if someone's a flight risk, which I proved I wasn't because I had shown up all the time and I had a family there, or if they're a danger to society, then you have to remand them to custody until they're sentenced, because you don't know if they're going to run or they're going to do something to harm someone. And this was a terribly cruel thing I found, that why would they remand me into, basically you're put in wherever they collect people off the street who've been stabbing and shooting and beating people up, and everyone is sent to this remand center, even the ones sent to the federal penitentiary eventually. So this was a terribly scary thing, because I had no idea when I said goodbye to my girls in the morning, I had no idea that that's the last time I'd necessarily see them for a little while. And I found out later through a lawyer, this is what was the judge's ploy as a way to force my hand to get a lawyer, because you can't, if you are defending yourself, you have no, it is practically impossible to get time to do your own legal research when you're stuck in remand. They give you maybe an hour every couple days. You don't even know what books to ask for, so you have to know exactly what to ask for if you want to get the book to study up so that you can defend yourself. So I think this was a ploy on the part of the judge in this case to force their hand to get a lawyer. So basically, and also what he could have done, because I had a friend who'd gone through some, not issues from taxes, but some other legal issues, and we'd always been in a court where there was a lot more privacy. In this case, he made sure to have me shackled and in front of a courtroom that was full of people. And they made sure to do the same thing during sentencing. Instead of the courtroom across the hall, that usually was a little more for privacy, they wanted publicity. So this was really important. Me being a higher profile person in the community, it was very important for them to, I guess, get a public hanging of the carcass to show people. Because the prosecutor had said many times, the issue of this isn't to correction for the crime, it's got nothing to do with punishment, it's to set a general deterrent for the rest of society. It's really important we hammer home a strong message of deterrence for the rest of Canadians. So I was remanded for 14 days. Then we went before the judge. He still couldn't make up his mind, so I was dragged. By the way, when you get in and out of remand, you get searched and seized. You're naked, you're bending over, you're doing all of these different things each time you're going out of remand to go to court and come back. They want to make sure you're not smuggling drugs or anything like that back in. So again, he didn't make up his decision. I had to come back 3 days later, and then he came down with his sentence, which was 16 months imprisonment plus approximately $190,000 in fines once I was released from prison, 3 months after I was released from prison. So then I went through 4 weeks of just trying to get out on appeal. So I was stuck for 4 weeks in general population trying to get out on appeal. And, I was very fortunate in that when I was first put into the remand center, you get roomed with someone else. You're in a cell, like bunk bed like system, in a tiny cell. And there was a fellow in there who I think he was a high profile person as well, because he was in for, there was an Amber Alert because he had apparently kidnapped his girlfriend and daughter, which I got the privilege of seeing later on. Actually, he was innocent, because camera footage showed that they were there by, what was it? They were there by their own volition, and it was an ex-boyfriend of this woman who had reported this Amber Alert. So this poor guy had gone through a lot as well. So he actually he'd been there for a little while, and when he was young, he'd had, a manslaughter charge from vehicular manslaughter that when he was 19 years old, and he was now in his 30s. So he kind of had known what the jail system had been about. He'd experienced it, so he really taught me different things, not to challenge anyone, look someone in the eye, yet don't stand down, and don't let yourself be walked on. There's a fine line you have to walk. So there was that, and then when I got into the general population for that 28 days, you start off in a dual cell. So again, you're bunked with someone, a little toilet in the corner that you have to use. And you get to graduate. So the longer you're there, as soon as someone gets released from that section of 24 gentlemen on this one little range that you're in, you get to the bottom eight in seniority are in a double room, and then you graduate to a single cell. So the whole goal is to graduate to your single cell. This is probably the hardest part of this whole ordeal for me, because the cellmate I was put in this case, had a lot of mental instability and didn't feel like taking his meds. So he would try and take his meds and sell them to someone else. So there were moments I would come back and he'd just glare at me and say, "This is my effing house. You get out of here." I said, "Well, listen, I got as much right to be." So this is where I had to learn to just stand my ground and yet find that fine line between safety and not doing anything stupid. What I knew about this fellow was that he greatly wanted the ability to play the guitar in the room and not, you see, you start a fight, you get in trouble, they'll send you to the hole really easily, which is a private area where it's 23 and a half hours, you're locked up, you don't get to roam around much. He really didn't want to go there. So, and the funny thing about this cellmate is he would do this and then the next morning he'd be so repentant. "I'm so sorry I did that. I never meant to do that." And so, you know, I understood. I tried to be as compassionate as I was, but there was one evening where I was, you know, sleeping going, "Oh, what's going to happen? Am I going to be safe sleeping in this bunk above this guy?" At this point, I was angry because I felt, what is going on? What am I doing in this place? I don't belong here. But I was also just trying to get out. It was that not knowing, okay, what's going on? Okay, because my wife's on the outside trying to find a lawyer that can try and, you know, get me out on appeal so that we can have a chance to appeal this. That was finally done. And so 3 years later, through different levels of appeals, finally my wife was, her charges are now dropped because there was a mistrial. They kept proceeding with the trial through her. She miscarried at the beginning of the trial, and they wouldn't postpone the trial for us. So she was in the hospital. I had to go there. They wouldn't let me go with her. I had to stay in there for the part of the trial. So there was what I felt a lot of cruelty and actually unfairness in that situation, which finally it took two courts of appeal to finally say, "Hey, you know what? That's not right. She shouldn't have been put through this." So 3 years later, which was this last January 2013, we went into the final Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, and we didn't know it at the time, but our lawyer that we found, which is a great appeal lawyer, like he was great for arguing for individual human rights. He was dying of a liver cancer, and so he died. That was the last time he appeared in court, and he was from Victoria, BC. And so we knew that, this might be the end of our fight. Our plan was always to go to the Supreme Court of Canada if we had to. But at this point, now if you think about it, this has been 5.5 years since that search and seizure. So our lives have been pretty miserable up to this point. Tired of the fight. And so with our lawyer passing away, that was enough to finally have us decide, you know what, I think I'm just going to give up, take my spanking, so to speak, and let's just move forward with our lives. As soon as I made that decision not to appeal to the Supreme Court, that's when they decided to drop what was going on with my wife. So it was a game they were playing. They wanted me, but as soon as they realized I was going to stop fighting for myself, they just let her go. She's small fish. They don't care about her, in other words. So this time, it was May 9th of last year, 2013, when... Actually, it was May 2nd when the decision came down to say, hey, they're not granting me the appeal. And I finally had that. I asked, listen, can I have a week to try and set my affairs in order? So they gave me that, which was very, very kind, actually, of the Crown Prosecutor at that time. And what was easier this time is I knew what to expect. I knew the range I was going into. They try to put you in with people that you'd be compatible with. So they wouldn't put me on a range with gangs. They put me on the range where you've got, on our range was a lot of gentlemen who, maybe they drank and drove too much. And so they're middle age or older, and they just, you know, hey, 8-9 times is enough. Serve some time is what they've been told. As well as some of the milder sexual related offenses, the ones that aren't longer than 2 years, like penitentiary time, would be there. And those gentlemen do not, they get harassed a lot. So they wanted them on a range where people that maybe are misfits or don't fit in. And that's where they put me. So like I said, the good thing this time was that I knew what to expect. And I think that made it a lot easier on me. And at that point, there was a level of acceptance of, you know what, I could have fought, but I've decided, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And that helped me out a lot because instead of focusing so much on my injustice at the time, when I was there this recent time, I got to actually know some of the guys that were on that range, start to socialize with them a little bit, and see certain things. Like a lot of these guys, you know, were not bad when they weren't inebriated or on drugs. Made some bad choices, some bad decisions, but weren't bad at all. And I realized there's not much I can do about my circumstances right now. We can only control how we respond to life. We can't control what life throws at us. And this was important for me to get. And I tried to embody this as much as I could. Trust me, there were times when I felt a little sorry for myself and really pissed off, really angry at the injustice of it all. But then I started thinking, as I started to seethe with that anger as I'm lying in my cell, it's not getting me anywhere. It's just harming me. And that's when I'd go back to that concept of I have to make the best of my situation. And I've always taken the attitude that whatever you want more of, give to others. So in other words, if you want more peace and understanding, then try and help others find peace and understanding, and that will come your way. And so I had these original cellmates this time who were very, very kind. One was two middle-aged gentlemen. One, and then he graduated, and I had someone else as a cellmate. And they were very scared. Very, very scared. And so I got to take the role of saying, listen, this is okay. You'll get through this. You'll get through this. And one of them was in on... not child abduction, but a couple steps milder than that. But I mean, he was being basically, if other inmates know the charge, they know the charge. There was newspaper articles written about him. The newspaper likes to, you know, flourish, likes to embellish things. Sorry. And so his life was hellish. He was threatened with getting beaten up all the time. In fact, the cellmate before me, he didn't know, but I found out from another inmate, someone was going to pay him to beat him up, beat him senseless overnight in the cell. And so what I first tried to do was try to say, listen, I want to know what went on. I want to know your side of what happened. And I'm going to question you because, you know, I want to know. And I'll be your advocate here because I want these guys to start. We need to understand we all mess up. And this is what I want to let these guys know. You can judge this guy messed up worse than you or whatever, but you know what? Everyone's in here because they messed up in some way. And you don't want someone judging you for that. Why would you want to judge someone else for the same thing? And the nice thing was, is by the five, I spent 5 months here, by the way, before I got out on some early release. He had a job. He was spoken to by probably 80 to 90% of the guys. He was respected. People would play chess with him. They didn't ostracize him anymore, which was quite beautiful because there was a gentleness and a kindness to him. You could sense there were a few guys there that you got a sense that, oh, this guy doesn't belong here. He's not made of that, kind of cut from that certain cloth to really handle being here very, very well. I was fortunate because I've always been a bit of a chameleon in that I can hobnob with intellectuals, but I can also, you know, hang with someone who every third word is a curse word if I have to. And that comes from understanding that I've always felt a desire to make others comfortable in my presence, and that helps a lot in what I do in my practice. And so that usually involves not making someone feel wrong for how they are, and so I'll usually try and mirror, you know, if their energy is a little more loose and a little more slang, I will mirror that. After the first month, I actually graduated to my own cell. And this was huge for me because at 1 o'clock till 2 o'clock every day on this range, you see there are these 12 cells around on the upstairs, 12 cells on the downstairs that surround this kind of 40-foot by 40-foot open area where guys can play cards or there's a TV in the corner people can watch. And I would, there was a guitar that was there. And so I had an opportunity to sometimes play, and I would just hack around and play some songs and quiet and depending on the time, because you also want to be respectful of other people might be sleeping or napping. Because there's nothing worse than being really obnoxious and inconsiderate, I guess. There's certain rules you have to follow when you're in there. And that was one of them. But the guy seemed to like it enough that asked me to play a few tunes. But once I got my own cell, I got my alone time from 1 to 2. We used to call it kindergarten nap time. It was like they'd send you to, okay, it's 1 o'clock, everyone locked up in your cells. And I guess the guards got to do jail business or whatever. And so we get locked up. But this is a time where I really took advantage of being able to meditate. I got just close my eyes, focus on my breathing. And it's funny, because if I didn't do that, it was in those periods where I was alone that I would start seething with anger. And so I can honestly say that quieting my mind, getting focused into my body, meditating was so soothing for me. Within a couple weeks, I actually got a job, which is I got paid $2 a day. This is what you get if you get a job, on top of the $1 a day you get to be there. So I got to work in stock rooms. I got to haul heavy boxes, which was good because I liked the physical activity. It was like working out a little bit. And then I started to realize I wanted more opportunities getting out. And I had musical talent, so I went to chapel on a Sunday morning, and the chapel band, I could see they needed a bassist, and I didn't play bass, but I've got enough of an ear for music that I started helping out playing bass and filled in for the piano player when he wasn't there. Then the lead singer eventually left. He was released, and they had no one. So I said, well, I'll step up. And so I got to be the lead singer and bass player in the chapel band. And a lot of guys come up. So I ended up writing a couple songs for that, which was really interesting because I definitely don't espouse or follow a lot of Christian principles. Not principles. I'm not very Christian religious, let's put it that way. And it was difficult because it's trying to go in an environment like that and extract something good for your soul, and yet there were times I cringe with what the chaplain would say. But I tried to find a way to be there and not be incongruent with who I was. And so I wrote a couple songs, actually, that were very Christian-messaged and brought them out. And it was really, really interesting because how many guys came up after me and said, you know, that moved me so much. It made such a difference to me. You know, I can't see my family here, and you have no idea how much of a difference that made for me. And so it was, I can't tell you how much easier it was for me to be in that situation once I knew that I could make that difference. It suddenly made it all make sense, whereas up to that point you could say it's not fair, it's not right, why is the universe and God or whatever doing? It's easy to fall into that victimhood kind of role. But that didn't serve me at all. And I found that when I was not in that role, and I could actually take the role of, okay, universe, use me. What can I do that's good here to make a difference? Because there's a lot of guys there that didn't have an opportunity to have a lot of good positive messages sent their way. And so I found this band was a chapel band was a great way to use that. And what was really neat was one of the chaplains was a female chaplain from the Salvation Army, and she wanted to get to know me. And so I tried to express my beliefs, which are very much like the principles in our Unitarian, on the back sheet of the Unitarian information that we have. And I was concerned, you know, that she would judge me as some kind of non-Christian heathen, and what was I doing, you know, playing in that band. And actually what was really sweet was she just wanted me to not judge her for her beliefs. And I said, wow, I would never judge you. I said, I believe everyone should have the right to find their own truth. If this has made meaning for you, if this turned your life around, if Christianity did that for you, religions, I don't have a problem with religion. It's a tool. It can be used for wondrous things. It can be used in the names of horrors as well. But it's just a tool to be used. I said, I have no problem with that. And so that was something that was eye-opening for me, because I always thought that, geez, you know, I was afraid of being judged for my beliefs. And here she was, a chaplain, a minister, who the same thing. Here I was, she thought, I had some secular beliefs. I wasn't really full on board with the Christian thing. But she was coming from the same place. So it was a really neat moment that we had there. I actually felt more connected to the First Nations. You see, they have spiritual programs there as well, where they'll do sweat lodges. And I had been to two before in my life and got a profound experience from that. So every month, every 3 to 4 weeks, actually, they would offer one for our range. And so I was the only white person that was allowed to go, so I don't know why that was, but, you know, I appreciated that. And actually, that's where I actually got a lot of meaning. It was a Lakota Sioux elder that led the ones that I did. And which brings up the other issues, that there was a little bit of prejudice. It's interesting, in the programming of the prison system, there was a little prejudice, I think, against whites and beneficial towards the First Nations people, whereas with the guards, there was more of a prejudice against the First Nations people, they treated, I think, the white prisoners a little bit better. And I think that's changing. I talked to a guard about it, and he said they're trying to change that. Like, they're trying to indoctrinate them with, you know, seeing past the color and the background. But that's where I spoke to them. I said, listen, I mean, I'm getting a lot from here. Is there an opportunity, maybe some other non-First Nations people could have a chance to, you know, attend if they want? Because that's the one thing that was missing, was what does someone do if they want some kind of connection to something greater, say a spiritual connection, like I feel when I come here, but you're not Christian, or you're not First Nations. And so I think that was something that was missing. You know, that was something that was really missing here. Difficulties accessing reading materials I wanted made it very, very difficult. There's I had a lot of inmates that had attended different correctional centers across Canada, a couple over 10 actually, and they'd said this was the worst experience they found as far as limitations on your freedoms. And so I found that really interesting. It seems like if someone breaks a rule once, and suddenly they make a new regulation that restricts and restricts and restricts. So over time, you just get more and more and more restrictions. And this was really difficult. In the end, like I said, I tried to connect with everyone there. I tried to have a meaningful moment with each of the 24 different guys that were there. And sometimes guys would leave, and sometimes guys would come back. Some more than others. I tried to help them as far as health goes, with understanding not just physical and nutritional health, but maybe ways of... I felt like I was a little bit of a psychologist or something, infiltrating. I was like a secret agent at some level, trying to... In fact, a lot of the guards would kind of pull me aside and said, we see what you're doing. We like it. You know, it's creating some harmony here. The team leader, who's the head of all the guards, quite like that. And I kind of made a joke with them, please don't let that be a reason to try and keep me longer, though. So what was really wonderful is I was released into the halfway house in Regina October 3rd, and then I was given an early release, which just had conditions of reporting once a week, on December 11th. And on the 20th, I think it was around the 20th, I received a Christmas card signed by all the guys on the unit that was there. So someone had taken their own little paltry money and had, from the canteen, you get to order once a week, junk food or whatever, ordered a Christmas card. All the guys signed it and said, you miss you, hope you're doing well. And I've still got that in my office. I tell you, that was powerful. I don't know that's a regular occurrence. So I'd like to, what I did was I wrote a lot of songs while I was in there. Between August 6th and September 20th, I wrote about 20 different songs in that time. And I'd just like to play you one of them. And I'll get my daughter up here, who's now cowering. Come on up, sweetie. We got your guitar up here. So this is a song you have there. It's called Peace Will Pave the Way. A lot of the songs I wrote were for a band that I'm in now that was a little more of an alternative rock band. This is a little more folky. So I thought this would be quite appropriate for here. And please feel free, if you want to sing along, if you get the sense of the chorus. I'm going to turn this off now, okay?
I was going to ask you, where were you at the men's max? Where and did you? How much of your original sentence did you actually have to serve in the end?
Hello? Hello? That's better? Okay. I had it off. I was actually just at Regina Correctional Center, just here, just east of town. And I served 5 of the 16 months, actually. So, well, actually, it's not true. 7 when you count the time in 2010 before I was out on appeal. Yes?
My impression is that the modern prison system has substituted psychological tortures for physical tortures, which used to be used many years ago. And that I'm supposing, and I'm just wondering whether you can tell me whether any of this is true, that there are many people in the prison system today who would much rather get the lash and or other physical punishments rather than the psychological punishments to which they are subjected.
Yeah.
Is there any truth in that observation?
There might be. I can tell you I had this distinct feeling that you felt like a plant that was... You see, I live at home. When I'm at home, I've got my wife and my 3 daughters, and there's flowers and art, and there's a lot of beauty around me. And so I felt like this flower there that was not allowed to get sunlight and water, and I felt like at the soul level, I was really withering. And that was the hard part for me, was the withering of the soul. There were inmates there that swore, you know, they'd be told certain things, and I think certain guards got pleasure out of kind of saying, okay, we're going to do this, and then not living up to their words, because there was this feeling of helplessness. And yeah, for them it was mental torture. It was this feeling that I'm being toyed with, and there's nothing I can do about it at all. And so there was one, actually, that had said, you know, I liked in the old days when you just got physically punished for it. At least I knew where I stood and it was done with. Whereas this, it's I don't know what's coming next. And so there might be some aspect of that. I'm not sure. I can't really speak to what the penitentiary system's like in Prince Albert, because it is a different system. They tend to get a little more freedoms, actually, believe it or not, than the correctional center. But it's a much harder lifestyle. You get some fellows in there that are in there for life, and you know, for a few bucks, they'll carve someone up for you if you don't like them, because I'm in here for life anyway. So yeah. So hopefully that answers your question. Yes.
One more, and then we'll have to continue downstairs later.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just experienced deja vu. I was one of the cooks at the halfway houses. There used to be 2 of them.
Wow.
You must have been probably in Scarth. No, I can't think of the other one.
No, Smith. I was on Smith Street.
And I was in Lorne.
Evelyn was
yes,
there.
Yes, she actually took my job when I was forced to leave because
wow.
I was ill. I feel exactly as you do, and I experienced exactly what you did with the men. My job was to visit with them and cook their meals, and I didn't have any supervision over them at all, which put me in the most idyllic position, and I just fell in love with those men.
Mm.
And I teased with them and laughed with them. They confided in me, and I used to call them my bad boys. And it was the most incredible 4 years of my professional life. So thank you so much. I was living in the past again.
Oh, so my pleasure.
I'm glad things turned out sort of for you.
Thank you. And that CTR house, the community training residence she's talking that she worked at, which is like the halfway house, what a beautiful experience that was compared with in the prison system. They believe in more of an active role in containment. They give you a lot of leeway. You know, they say, okay, they're going to basically trust you first until you screw up, basically. So it was a wonderful where you got the sense that the workers there actually cared about you, which was different from probably 3/4 of the guards. There's about 1/4 that were really wonderful, actually. But there was that other 3/4 that they were obviously just there to collect a paycheck, and the inmates were an annoyance. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. There was an account a year or so ago on the CBC of another gentleman that had run afoul of the Canada Revenue Agency, and they kept claiming that he owed them money, and he kept saying, no, I do not. He had accountants' records to indicate that he had done everything correctly. They twice lost his documents. He and his wife had bought property in BC to create in a wonderful valley a place where people come and bring their RVs and whatever, and this was going to be their retirement. They bought the property, they were going to manage it and live there. And of course they had to sell that to pay for the legal advice and the accountancy advice over several years of fighting with the Canada Revenue Agency. And in the last analysis, it turned out that they owed him money. He did not owe them money. But, I mean, everything that he had to go through to finally get justice was quite incredible.